It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And I suggest you have a pencil and paper handy because there might just be something you want to write down. Here we go. Let's start off with announcements. Stand up for native forests. Stop genetically engineered trees. Resist the Tree Biotechnology 2013 conference, taking place May 26th through June 1st in Asheville, North Carolina. Join Earth First Global Justice Ecology Project and the Stop GE Trees campaign for a week of resistance to genetically engineered trees. At the end of May, the International Tree Biotechnology 2013 conference is taking place in Asheville, North Carolina. This conference is a gathering of many of the major players in the genetically engineered tree business, and we intend to greet them with spirited protest. Timber and utility corporations want to plant millions of acres of genetically engineered trees throughout the South to burn for electricity as well as to continue supplying the unsustainable lumber and paper industries. These trees would be engineered to produce their own pesticides, grow straighter and faster, tolerate manufactured pesticides, produce sterile seeds, and reduce their lignin content. If these traits escaped into native tree populations, the effects could be devastating and irreversible. United States Department of Agriculture is already considering approving an industry request to sell billions of genetically engineered freeze-tolerant eucalyptus trees. These non-native invasive and flammable trees pose an unprecedented threat to the forests and communities of the southern United States. We stand to lose tens of thousands of acres of our diverse and resilient native forests to sterile monoculture tree plantations that support few, if any, of the native species. These protests will send a critical message to the USDA as they are poised to approve the first ever commercial planting of genetically engineered eucalyptus trees in several southern states. So come join activists from around the country for an action-packed week of resistance to genetically engineered trees. We are kicking off the week with a teach-in on May 27th, followed by a mass march to the conference center on May 28th. We are organizing and encouraging affinity group actions throughout the week to ensure the GE tree industry does not get a moment's rest during their stay in Asheville. For more information, contact Katua Earth First at riseup.net. That's K-A-T-U-A. Earth, K-A-T-U-A-H, Earth First at riseup.net. Katua Earth First at riseup.net. And once again, those dates are May 26th through June 1st in Asheville, North Carolina. Also coming up is the 2013 Mountain Justice Summer Action Camp from May 19th to the 27th. Join the Mountain Justice this May 19th through the 27th for our 9th annual Mountain Justice Action Summer Training Camp. And that's taking place near Damascus, Virginia. Mountain Justice has grown from a fast-burning brush fire, like they have in L.A. today, that helped push mountaintop removal to national awareness into a critical support network at the base of a growing national anti-extractive industry movement for social and environmental justice. This year, it's time to fan the flames of resistance to dirty energy and put an end to mountaintop removal once and for all, while continuing to support bottom-up economic transition for a brighter Appalachia. Will you join us as we build pressure and momentum to stop strip mining and other destructive extractive industries in Appalachia? Mountain Justice Summer Camp is a place to learn skills, expand on the ones you already have, strengthen connections in networked social movements for justice, meet new allies, and take action to stop the destruction of Appalachia. And I'm going to skip down here because I've read this a couple of times. The final schedule will be released later, but you can register now at www.mountainjustice.org. To be notified for updates on camp schedule and other Mountain Justice events, sign up for our news and announcement list. Registration fees are sliding scale based on your ability to pay, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. They do provide 3 meals a day, a place to sleep, and amazing trainers from across our region, so they're asking for $15 to $50 donation per day. Or if you can afford it, $150 to $500 for the duration of the camp. Hope to see you in May. For more information, go to www.mountainjustice.org. And in activist news this week, Greenpeace activists went on board an Australian coal ship in a reef protest. Reporting by Thayong, reporting, editing by Paul Tate from World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Six Greenpeace activists boarded a coal ship bound for South Korea near Australia's Great Barrier Reef on Wednesday, protesting against the expansion of the rich Australian coal industry and its impact on the World Heritage Site. Environmentalists say that the Great Barrier Reef, a popular tourist site worth about $6 billion Australian dollars to the Australian economy, is threatened by dredging, sedimentation, coal, and shipping port development. UNESCO will decide in June whether the reef should be listed as a World Heritage Site in danger. The ship MV Meister was carrying thermal coal from Abbott Point in northern Queensland State, a port that falls within the Great Barrier Reef Heritage Area, and was still in Australian waters in the Coral Sea when it was boarded en route to Donghae in South Korea. They have established a peaceful occupation of the ship, said Georgiana Woods, a campaigner with on board Greenpeace flagship the Rainbow Warrior. Activists launched inflatable boats from the Rainbow Warrior and boarded the coal vessel early on Wednesday. A letter was handed to the captain of the ship detailing their reasons for the occupation. Ordinary people will have to stand up to stop the expansion of coal exports, and that's what Greenpeace is doing today, Wood said. The Australian Coal Association, an advocacy body representing the industry, said the action was dangerous and irresponsible. Coal is Australia's second largest commodity, with exports increasing some 50% over the past 10 years and worth almost $60 billion Australian in 2011 and 12. We need to ensure that our sector remains internationally competitive to ensure that Australia benefits from the sustainable development of its coal resources, said Nikki Williams, CEO of the Australian Coal Association. The Australian people have not given Greenpeace a veto over its economic future. Heralded as one of the seven natural wonders of the world, the 2,000-kilometer-long Great Barrier Reef is home to 400 types of coral, 240 species of birds, and 1,500 species of fish. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field, and that's a pretty long one. Things are heating up out there. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols are seeing the gift of new buffalo calves nearly every day. It is amazing to watch a family group and see the big round bellies of pregnant buffalo, knowing they will soon give birth, and then days or hours later to see the wee red calves next to their proud and protective mothers. A buffalo calf is afforded not only the uncompromising protection of her mother, but of the whole family. There is little that can penetrate the woolly walls of security, yet when the herd is threatened, all must flee, and the little legs of brand new buffalo babies must give their all to keep up. Such has been the introduction to life for some wild buffalo calves, as government hazing activities have continued near West Yellowstone in the choice habitat of the Denny Creek area. On Tuesday, wild buffalo challenged Montana Department of Livestock inspectors with their presence here, a place that is perfectly suitable for wild buffalo, save for the intolerance of a couple of property owners who currently host no livestock. Nearly 80 buffalo, mostly family groups with new calves and pregnant buffalo, dotted the landscape. When Montana Department of Livestock Inspector Bridger Cunningham found them here, he called for reinforcements, stating that they had a wreck on their hands. Montana Department of Livestock Inspector Mark Anderson eventually joined him. They mounted up and began to chase the buffalo. A couple of hours later, Montana Department of Livestock Inspector Jeff Bowers and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Warden Jim Smolzinski joined in the chase. Not a few buffalo resisted this abuse, momentarily escaping the agents. Buffalo Field Campaign was not the only media group bearing witness either. We were joined by France 2, a French TV station covering the issue. By day's end, wild buffalo had been shoved around along fences through housing areas, wetlands, and creeks, and into Gallatin National Forest for a number of miles. But by Wednesday morning, most of those buffalo had returned to Denny Creek. The vexing games began again on Wednesday morning. More government employees were called in to assist the Montana Department of Livestock's forced removal of wild bison. Buffalo Field Campaign volunteers reported writers representing the Montana Department of Livestock, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Yellowstone National Park, and USDA Animal Plant and Inspection Service, or APHIS, along with law enforcement officers with the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service. Through the heart of threatened grizzly bear habitat, government agents yelled at wild bison as they chased them in stampedes through the fields, streams, and forests. From start to finish, 7 hours and 8 miles later, the riders finally ended the haze and left the exhausted and annoyed buffalo to themselves. The buffalo, of course, turned right around and started heading back again. This is the tip of the bison abuse iceberg here in the Hebgen Basin. Soon, taxpayer-funded industrial-strength buffalo mismanagement will commence, forcing all wild buffalo out of their native Montana into Yellowstone National Park just in time for the summer tourist season to begin. In the Gardner Basin, the landscape has been saying its farewells to her beneficial buffalo as they make their way south into the park's interior. Eight mature bulls that had been spread out east of the Yellowstone River were hazed by the government late last week. The bulls are supposed to be allowed in this area, but likely the agents feared that they, like the 41 residents we mentioned last week, would follow the scent trail of a lone bull that the Montana Department of Livestock shot and left to rot on Dome Mountain. The media has continued to cover this reprehensible action, and Montana Department of Livestock is still receiving some well-earned bad press. So many of the buffalo suffering these abusive government operations have been experiencing such maltreatment their entire lives, since they too were weak calves. Their experience of humans has been a confusing juxtaposition between tourists who cherish and adore them and those who want to abuse and kill them. It is our intent that this next generation of wild buffalo will grow to be truly wild and free. The man-made lines in the sand erased before they reach maturity. With your continued support, we can make this a reality. And introducing the Buffalo Field Campaign's Free Buffalo Museum. Buffalo Field Campaign is pleased to announce that we are making a transition this summer from tabling inside Yellowstone National Park to opening a free buffalo museum just outside the west entrance in the town of Yellowstone, West Yellowstone. The museum will take you on an incredible buffalo journey through their storied history and amazing natural lives to their current plight and the efforts of the people standing in their defense. The museum will showcase photos, artwork, images, and video, as well as buffalo items you can touch, plus, of course, Buffalo Field Campaign merchandise. Standing guard and welcoming all will be our ever-popular Buffaloon, a gigantic inflatable buffalo who will lead the way to Buffalo Field Campaign's Free Buffalo Museum. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's wish list of featured items for this week. Flashlights. One of the challenges wild buffalo face during their migration is contact with U.S. Highways 191 and 287. Buffalo Field Campaign monitors these highways morning through night, putting up warning signs and taking other action to help reduce the chance of bison vehicle collisions. 7 wild buffalo have been killed along the roads this year, all at night. Bison are extremely hard to see at night, so Buffalo Field Campaign is out there to be visible for them. We are in need of high-powered flashlights to aid us in this task. We have glow cones that attach to flashlights, which we use at night when standing along the highways with our slow and stop paddles. We are in need of a specific type of mag light, costs $35, and it works with our glow cones, and we need a total of 4 of them. If you would like to help us purchase these items, please mark your donation for Safe Passage to ensure it goes into the appropriate budget. Thank you all so much for helping to keep us, the buffalo, and travelers safe on these dangerous highways. And you can send that donation to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Have any questions? Give them a call at 406-646-0070. And if you need any more information about anything about the Buffalo Field Campaign, go to their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And it's always good to remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And here's the forest update for April. I know it's May, but it came in late in the month. All right. We want to thank Jody Frediani for preparing the forest update every month, starting off with AB 350. This is California Assembly Bill 350, allows the cutting of 34-inch trees for fire protection. AB 350 was introduced by Assembly members Wykowski and Bigelow in the belief that state law inhibits fuel rejection exemption projects by limiting the diameter of trees that may be cut. They believe that landowners need to be able to log and sell larger trees to pay for fuel reduction projects. Thus, this bill would increase the allowable size of trees to be cut under exemptions in projects up to 300 acres from 18 inches to 28 inches. within 500 feet of a legally permitted structure or in an area prioritized as a shaded fuel break in a community wildlife protection plan approved by a public fire agency. This bill would increase the size of trees that can be cut from 24 to 34 inches. Science and experience tell us that larger trees are more fire resistant and provide more shade to reduce the growth of flammable understory trees and to keep ground temperatures cooler. This bill targets the wrong trees and will not provide increased fire protection. It will allow for more timber harvesting of larger trees without any CEQA equivalent environmental review. It will alter the earlier compromise crafted to facilitate fuel reduction, which already allowed for harvest of larger trees for the sole purpose of providing income incentive to timberland owners. And last but not least, AB 350 will provide another giveaway to the timber industry, which last year shifted its costs for fire protection and timber harvest environmental review to rural homeowners and the state's taxpayers. This bill will be heard, or I guess it was heard, in the Assembly Natural Resources Committee on April 29th. Moving on to Assembly Bill 904, the NTMP expansion to 15,000 acres. This bill by Assemblymember Wes Chesbro will phase out the Non-Industrial Timber Management Plan program and replace it with the Working Forest Management Plan program for timber landowners with up to 15,000 acres. The current NTMP program is open to timber landowners with up to 2,500 acres. In spite of expressing our views that such expansion should not be allowed in the southern sub-district, that is Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, San Mateo, San Benito counties, it has not been excluded from the proposed program. While the new vehicle attempts to make improvements over the existing NTMP program, it falls far short. Weak language gives nod to erosion control plans, disclosure of existing or expected late successional forest requiring info on how it will be managed to preserve such characteristics, some vague scoping for listed species prior to subsequent entries, slightly longer agency review times, and monitoring potentially every 5 years. But none of these improvements are satisfactory in our opinion, nor does the new program provide any additional protection for neighbors and issues of public health, safety, and welfare. In fact, it appears to weaken such protection, as it will allow major amendments to be made without further public and agency review and participation, as is currently required. AB 904 does not include any provisions to ensure that approved mitigations are followed in all future entries. We have seen repeatedly that over time, as agency personnel move on and new registered professional foresters take over, or as the original registered professional foresters get old and forget, that such provisions get overlooked in the conduct of operations many years post-approval. This bill was also heard on April 29th. And in our local area here, there are a number of new timber harvest plans. THP 1-13-04, the size 138 acres, location is Mormon Gulch, which flows into Coralitos Creek. The owner is Matthew, the registered professional forester is Hildreth. THP 1-13-16 SCR, that's Santa Cruz, is a 25-acre THP on Shingle Mill Gulch, which is 1,500 feet downstream. The owner is Eloise Wilson, a trustee, and the registered professional forester is Hildreth. THP 1-13-017 in San Mateo County is a THP on the Gazos Creek Tree Farm. It is 365.2 acres, located on Gazos Creek. The owner is Redwood Empire, and the registered professional forester is Duffy. This plan includes skid trails and landings within Big Basin State Park and will haul through roads on Big Basin State Park where there is a right-of-way granted, smack through the middle of occupied marbled murrelet habitat. Joey states that she has never seen so many skid trails on a timber harvest plan map. Also up is THP 1-13-27 in Santa Cruz County, the Comstock Mill THP, which is located in the Soquel Demonstration Forest. It's 240 acres in size, and it's located along Amaya Creek and the East Branch of Soquel Creek. The owner is the Soquel Demonstration State Forest. The registered professional forester is Bullock. This plan was returned on April 18th with 20 insufficiencies, including a need to update the 303D assessment to include an additional stressor to Soquel Creek, which are pathogens, plus address the other stressors, Enterococcus, E. coli, fecal coliform, and turbidity. Non-Industrial Timber Management Plan 1-12-005 Santa Clara. This is not a new THP, but is still under review with new information. It's 177 acres in size and is upslope from Little Arthur Creek northeast of Corralitos. The owner is Bowles Farming Company Incorporated. The registered professional forester is Vaughn. Something very irregular is going, and Jody, these are Jody's notes. Something very irregular is going on with the noticing and info update for this plan. The second review team meeting was held March 19th with a tentative close of comment on March 29th, 2012. But the second review team recommendations did not get posted on CAL FIRE's FTP site until April 8th. No pre-harvest inspection was held for this NTMP. Additional new documents for this plan can be found under CAL FIRE's new mail section on the FTP site, but do not appear in the NTMP's plan folder. One such document includes an August 17, 2012 memo from Santa Clara County submitted to the registered professional forester Bill Vaughn on March 8th of 2013. So that's all very weird. And Jody ends up the forestry report for April with trees call for help and now scientists can understand. When drought hits, trees can suffer, a process that makes sounds. Now scientists have found the key to understanding those cries for help. In the lab, a team of French scientists has captured the ultrasonic noise made by bubbles forming inside water-stressed trees. Because trees also make noises that aren't related to drought impact, scientists hadn't before been able to discern which sounds are most worrisome. With this experiment, we start to understand the origin of acoustic events in trees, says Alexander Ponomarenko, a physicist at Grenoble University in France, whose team conducted the research. This discovery could help scientists figure out when trees are parched and need emergency watering, added Ponomarenko, who presented his team's results last month in the American Physical Society meeting in Baltimore, Maryland. And that's the forestry report for April, and I again apologize for not getting to it until May, presented by Jody Frediani, the forestry consultant for the Loma Prieta chapter of the Sierra Club. Thank you, Jody. And California authorities have targeted the smuggling of bladders from endangered fish in this story, but written by Marty Graham, with editing by Alex Dubazinskis and Peter Cooney of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. U.S. border officers in California are seizing a large number of smuggled bladders from an endangered fish that are prized for use in Chinese soups, with seven people charged since February in connection with the trade, authorities said. The bladders of the Totoaba McDonaldy fish were smuggled across the border from Mexico, with each organ fetching $5,000 on the U.S. black market and over $10,000 in Asia, federal prosecutors said. The fish is found in the Gulf of California between the Mexican mainland and Baja California. The Totoaba's swim bladder is a tube-shaped organ that fills with gas to help control the buoyancy of the fish, which the U.S. Attorney's Office said can grow to over 6 feet long, weigh up to 220 pounds, and live to an age of 25. The U.S. listed the Totoaba as an endangered species in 1979, and they are also protected in Mexico. Officials said the fish's bladder was seen in some Chinese cuisine as a prime ingredient in a type of soup and prized for its supposed ability to boost fertility and circulation. The Mexican fish is very similar to a Chinese species of fish which was eaten to extinction, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent in Charge Jill Burchell told reporters. The Totoaba spawn in the spring, and during that time they swim to shallow waters at the mouth of the Colorado River on the north end of the Gulf of California, and fishermen begin to go after them as the black market trade in the animals' swim bladders heats up, officials said. The shores are littered with carcasses because catching them, the Totoaba, is illegal, and they don't want to have to move the entire fish Burchell said. In the latest case that led to criminal charges, a U.S. Customs and Border Protection officer inspected a car at the Calexico Mexicali port of entry, about 130 miles east of San Diego, found 27 Totoaba bladders hidden under floor mats in the backseat of a car, U.S. prosecutors said in a statement. Federal agents returned all but one bladder to the driver, Songshen Zen, 73, of Calexico, California, officials said, but the officer thought something was fishy. Federal agents followed Zen to a rented house in Calexico. When they returned to the home with a search warrant, they found over 200 of the fish bladders spread out on floors and counters to dry, officials said. They also found packing material and ledgers for other shipments that went to China and Hong Kong, said U.S. Attorney Laura Duffy. In all, the bladders taken from Zen could have fetched more than $3.6 million in foreign markets. Zen was charged last Friday with smuggling and unlawful importation of wildlife, and convicted, he faces up to 20 years in prison. Six other people have been charged since February in connection with the smuggling of endangered fish bladders in cases authorities said are not related. And in two of those cases, the defendants are still at large. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has created the first bighorn sheep herd in 25 years. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife, along with volunteers from around the state, has established a new herd of federally endangered Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep. This is the first reintroduction effort for a new herd of Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep since 1988, said Tom Stevenson, CDFW Bighorn Recovery Program leader. Historically, Sierra bighorn were abundant throughout the Sierra Nevada. However, in the 1970s, only two herds remained. Disease spread by domestic sheep and unregulated commercial hunting are believed to have caused their demise. Many endangered species remain on the brink of extinction with poor prospects for recovery after they receive federal protection, said Stevenson. Through our conservation efforts, we have a unique opportunity to reach recovery goals for an alpine specialist that is native only to California. During the week of March 25th, 10 female and 4 male bighorn sheep were captured from two of the largest existing herds in the Sierra Nevada and reintroduced to the vacant herd unit of Alancha Peak at the southern end of the range in Inyo County. Six additional females were moved to two small northern herds, Convict Creek and Mount Gibbs, for augmentation of those herds. Following this recent effort, there are now 10 herds of Sierra bighorn between Owens Lake and Mono Lake. Three additional herds are needed to meet recovery goals. The population currently numbers around 500 animals and is up considerably from a low of around 100. If you want more information, go to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife website, www.cdf.ca.gov. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is produced every week here at Free Radio on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock. It also is rebroadcast on Fridays at 3 p.m. If you want to listen to the Earth First Update, you can in Moscow, Idaho, you can do that on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, on a frequency of 92.5 FM on Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. If you want to download or listen to a podcast of this broadcast, you can do so at radioforall.net. Just search for Earth First Radio. Remember the exclamation point. That's Earth First Radio, and the Earth First Updates will pop up. I just want to say that I will be out of town next week, and there will be no Earth First Update at that time. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. It's produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in again next week for another edition of, well, actually not next week, in 2 weeks for another edition of the Earth First Update. Thank you for listening.